What are we aiming for in life? You know, what is your, as soon as this happens or as soon as that happens, life will be okay. For Usain Bolt in 2004, it was as soon as he gets in the Olympic team. Then it was as soon as he wins his first medal, then as soon as he wins his first gold medal. And then this summer in London, 2017, it was in as soon as he wins his final gold medal, he could retire. Now, sadly, for Usain Bolt, it didn't work out. Justin Gatlin spoilt the party. Now, what is your soon as? Now, for me, it is if we could get a dog. Now, when I say that to my family, they look at me and they say to me, look, we've already got a Yorkshire Terrier. What is your as soon as? As soon as I graduate, get a job, get a better job. As soon as I get married, get divorced, have more time, more money. As soon as he changes. As soon as she apologizes. As soon as they do what I want them to do. As soon as I get a holiday. As soon as I get out of London. As soon as I retire. You can fill in the blank with almost anything. What has to happen to make life finally worthwhile and bring rest to each one of us? And the man in our story is convinced that as soon as he sets foot at the right time in this magic pool of water, that life will be okay. Jesus is on the move again. Today he has traveled up to the capital. Verse 1. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now, Jerusalem would have been packed full of pilgrims. And Jesus finds himself there, verse 2, in the northeast corner of the city by a pool, located by the entrance known as the Sheep Gate. And it's known for its five covered colonnades. It's known for the name of Bethesda. It's also known as a place that is full of needy people. Verse 3. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie. The blind, the lame, the paralyzed. Why has Jesus sought out this pool? See, he knows this is where the broken of body go to get healed. It's also where you find the broken of soul. We see later on in this story that this man's real problem is much deeper than he thought. The broken bodies around that pool, in actual fact, are meant to be a spiritual picture, if you like, of us. And we are all spiritually blind, lame, disabled. You know, how many of us this evening genuinely do believe that as soon as that thing that we are longing for to happen, we genuinely believe that we will be well? Now, you might say to me, well, no, that's not me, Johnny. Then the question I would ask you is, why are you working so hard to achieve it? Ronnie Biggs, the great train robber, would do anything for money. And he said this, I remember what it felt like to hold £1 million in cash in my hand, but it didn't make me feel happy. Kurt Cobain, who worked tirelessly for fame, in his suicide note, he wrote this. I walk out on stage, hear the roar of the crowd. I've tried everything within my power to appreciate it, but it's not enough. Jesus has sought out this pool because there is one man who in particular needs healing. There is one man who has been looking to be well for an awful long time. See verse 5. And in typical Jesus fashion, he announces his arrival with a surprising question. Upon coming to the man, verse 6, Jesus immediately draws attention to us why this man is what this man is looking for, what he's hoping for. Jesus saw him there, lying there. this man is paralyzed and lays around the pool. You know, he's waiting with his friends because of the legend. The legend is that when the pool stirs, that is caused by an angel. It's there in verse 4, down there in the footnotes. The earliest manuscripts we have got on this passage from John don't include verse 4. And the chances are that somebody added an explanation of the historical context at a later date. The legend went that the angel got into the pool and stirred the waters. And if anybody got in while the angel was still there, they would be healed. Now, why the water moved is not clear. It might have been because of the wind. It might have been because of some movement under the water. We don't really know. But what we do know is that this man has been waiting there for an awful long time to be healed. 38 years. You'd have thought that he would have realized by now that, you know, it was never really going to deliver. Jesus approaches this man. He's not looking for Jesus. You know, he's too taken up with his plans of how he's going to get healed. You know, he's thinking to himself, he's thinking, you know, too busy thinking, you know, as soon as I get into that pool to notice Jesus. But Jesus arrests his attention with a question there, end of verse 6. Do you want to get well? Now, let's assume Jesus doesn't use superfluous words. Jesus has noticed something. This man seems to be imprisoned by his own sickness. So much so that when Jesus actually asks the question, do you want to get well? He doesn't immediately answer yes. No, it may be that he's either lost hope or it could be that he's afraid of getting better. I mean, this has become who he is. You know, this is what he does. What will happen if he gets better? You know, every day he goes down to this pool, he sits on his mat with his friends. It's become part of his identity. You know, there can be something comfortable and familiar with wallowing in our own need. And Jesus is asking here, do you really want to make you better? Do you really want me to make you better? When being an invalid has been your thing for so many years? The question is designed to rouse the man from his inactivity. And look at how the man responds. It seems to work there, verse 7. Sir, the invalid replied, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred, referring to the legend. See, he clearly interprets Jesus' question as an offer to help. Now, while I'm trying to get into the pool, somebody gets in ahead of me. And you know, yes, I do want to be well. In fact, if you wouldn't mind, next time the water's still, would you give me a hand or would you help me into the pool? Well, the question certainly roused him, but it also exposed the hopelessness of what this man has placed his hope in. For this paralyzed man, his hopes were placed entirely in the stirring of the waters. Now, I'm not sure if you've seen this week the story of the girl who flew to Amsterdam to meet a boy but was abandoned at the airport. It's gone viral. They met on holiday. It was in August, and they met in Barcelona. And it was a holiday romance. She fell very much in love with this young man. They texted, and they stayed in touch over the phone. And then he invited her to go to Amsterdam. But when Sophie arrived in Amsterdam, there was absolutely no sign of Jesse. She thought this was rather strange. She rang him, but there was no answer. She texted him again. There was no answer. And then she received a text message that said that the whole of this relationship had been a joke. That she had been pranked. Now, we've stood by, haven't we? And we've watched our friends fall in love with a good-for-nothing. But this was a cruel way to let somebody down. It was beyond all limits. It was a very hard way for her to see the hopelessness of what she was trusting in. Now, do we see the hopelessness of that thing or that person that we are trusting in? Do we see our well-being cannot be met by anything offered in this world? Mel Gibson, in an interview, said, I've been to the pinnacle of what this secular world had to offer. I put my proboscis out and sucked it up. But it wasn't enough. It just wasn't enough. Now, Jesus puts that question to us tonight. Do we want to get well? Do you see how entrapped you are by the treadmill of life? You know, as soon as I have this, as soon as I have that, that will give me my well-being. No, it won't. And you know it won't. There is only one who can make us well, as this man now discovers. See verse 8. Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The question, do you want to get well, is designed not only to rouse the man, but also it is designed to draw out deeper things going on this passage. Deeper spiritual truths. So we've encountered a surprising question. Now we encounter a surprising discovery. Douglas Adams, of hitchhiker fame, made a surprising discovery. He writes, "I got the time of the train wrong. I went to get myself a newspaper to do the crossword and a cup of coffee and a packet of biscuits. I went and sat at a table. There's a guy sitting opposite me. It didn't look like he was doing anything weird. What he did was this. He suddenly leaned across, picked up the packet of biscuits, tore it open, tore one out, and ate it. Now this, I have to say, is the sort of thing the British are very bad at dealing with. There's nothing in our background, upbringing, or education that teaches you how to deal with someone who in broad daylight has just stolen your biscuits. You know what would have happened if this had been South Central Los Angeles? There would have very quickly been gunfire, helicopters coming in, CNN, you know. But in the end, I did what any red-blooded Englishman would do. I ignored it. And I stared at the newspaper, took a sip of coffee, tried to do a clue in the newspaper, couldn't do anything, and thought, what am I going to do? In the end, I thought, nothing for it. I'll just have to go for it. And I tried very hard not to notice the fact that the packet was already mysteriously opened. I took out a biscuit for myself. I thought that settled him. But it hadn't, because a moment or two later, he did it again. He took another biscuit. Having not mentioned it the first time, it was somehow even harder to raise the subject the second time around. Excuse me, I couldn't help but notice. I mean, it doesn't really work. We went through the whole packet like this. He took one. I took one. Finally, when we got to the end, he stood up and walked away. Well, we exchanged meaningful looks, then he walked away. And I breathed a sigh of relief and sat back. A moment or two later, the train was coming in. So I tossed back the rest of my coffee, stood up, picked up the newspaper, and underneath the newspaper, to my surprise, were my biscuits. Now, you might have thought that this story is just another Jesus miracle. But there is a surprising discovery to be found. You know, the Bible tells us that as human beings, we are searching for rest, that we are restless animals. And you know, this is what is driving this sort of, as soon as that happens, as soon as this happens, mentality. You know, we're searching for peace, for meaning, for satisfaction. Pascal, the French philosopher, said, "What does all this restlessness and helplessness indicate, except that man was once in true happiness, which has now left him?" Adam and Eve enjoyed perfect peace until it was spoiled by sin. And ever since, we have been putting our hope in something to restore the rest enjoyed in the garden. Some have sought great wealth. Others have invested heavily in success. Still others, you know, religious people, have sought peace through rule-keeping. None of which works. And the legalism or rule-keeping of the Jews is evident in these next few verses. End of verse 9. "The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, 'It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat.'" Now, one thing that we have learnt about Jesus over these last few weeks is that he is intentional. And it's almost as if he's decided that I'm going to Bethesda. You know, I'm going to raise a miracle. I'm going to raise that man who I've seen there, sitting there for 38 years. And I'm going to do it on a Sabbath so I can raise the issue of the Sabbath. And look at the kerfuffle he has generated. Verse 16, the Jewish leaders are not happy. You see, this story before us this evening is really about a conflict over the Sabbath. This is the surprise. And if we're going to understand this miracle, we have to understand the significance of it. See, the Jews and the Pharisees over the ages had hijacked the Sabbath and all that it stood for, and Jesus wants it back. Now, the Jews, like many of us today, understood and thought the Sabbath was everything to do with not working. Hence the oppressive rules. In verse 17, Jesus corrects them when he says, "My Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working." The point being that God never stopped working on the Sabbath, which of course is often the basis for the rules. He just stopped creating. Genesis 2, verse 3. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. So what did God do? Did he stop doing? God stopped creating. And then he set about enjoying the Sabbath. The rest for that, of course, is what Sabbath means. See, the work of God's Sabbath was not a work of inactivity. It was full of activity. It was enjoying the paradise that he had created, and something that he did jointly with Adam and Eve. You know, there's nothing that he loved more, God, than to take a stroll in the cool of the day with Adam and Eve, enjoying all the wonderful work that he had done, all the creation that he had made. And Sabbath rest was not rudely interrupted by Monday morning. You see, there was no eighth day, actually. You know, life in the garden was one long summer's day, a never-ending party. Sabbath rest was the internal enjoyment for Adam and Eve of God and his creation. This was rest. And that is how things would have remained. You know, you and me living together in perfect harmony with ourselves, with one another, and with God forever. But for Adam and Eve's rebellion against God. And that came like a dagger into the heart of God's creation, interrupting God's Sabbath rest, and restlessness entered this world. So when God commanded the people of Israel to keep the Sabbath, it had less to do with people not working and everything to do with longing for rest. Longing for a rescuer to restore true rest, to inaugurate the new creation. This is verse 17. What God and his Son have been working towards together. The wine and grapes are a sign of new creation. And at the wedding in Cana, Jesus bursts forth to declare, "I am Lord of creation, and I am here to get this party started, to get this eternal rest started." Healing and restoring a broken body are a sign of new creation. And here in this story, Jesus announces to the Pharisees, "I am Lord of the Sabbath, the giver of true rest. I am here doing my Father's work of restoration. For I and the Father are one," verse 18. And the Pharisees, they don't like this. And we read they try all the more to kill him. See, Jesus looks around this pool of broken people and he says, "I am the giver of true rest." And he looks around this congregation this evening and he says, "I am the giver of true rest, true freedom from this cycle of restlessness. All of you, whether you've known me for years, Whether you've got to know me in the last few weeks, whether you'd like to get to know me tonight, come unto me and rest, those of you who are heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. What is sad is that the man here in this story is in danger of missing the true significance of Jesus. And the man, verse 13, had no idea who this man was that had healed him. But the story is not over. We've seen a surprising question. We've made a surprising discovery. Jesus now has a surprising challenge for this man. We have deeper meaning in that question, do you want to get well? We've seen that Jesus was asking, do you really want Sabbath rest? Do you want to party like it's the creation all over again? He now has a challenge for this man. You may have your legs back, but do you want to learn to dance with them? It would have been easy for Jesus to just have let this man go, but he goes in pursuit of him. You see, he won't give up on him, and he won't give up on you either. Jesus knows where he is going, verse 14, the temple. And that's where he catches up with him. And what follows is a bizarre challenge. See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. Now, it's easy to get entrapped in the cycle of restlessness. London seems to fuel that. But it's just as easy to get entrapped in a cycle of sin, so that it becomes part of our identity. Ben Gunn, a former British prisoner, described his release after 32 years to be deeply disturbing. I could see where I was in prison. I knew who I was and what I wanted to be. But that prison was a very small world, and this one is infinite. It's an identity thing. Now, it's deeply disturbing to see many prisoners re-offending and returning to the security of prison, since it is more familiar than the freedom of new life. Of course, there are many complex and sociological reasons for that. But it can be just as true for us in the new freedom offered in Christ. And some of us will testify to this. It's why so easily many of us do backslide into patterns of sin. But heed this warning tonight. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. I will never forget an old Free Church preacher who came to my church when I was a young teenager, and he preached powerfully, and he talked about the fact that God is love, and he said that love warns. He also told this story that terrified me then and terrifies me today. In the 18th century, Archibald Boyle was a leading member of a group known as the Hell Club in Glasgow for their wild and unsavoury parties. One night after the club's notorious annual meeting, Boyle dreamed he was riding home on his black horse. In the darkness, someone seized the reins, shouting, "You must go with me." He fought to get free, but he was being dragged down into hell. At the entrance to hell, Boyle desperately pleaded, "Take me from this place. By the living God whose name I have so often outraged, I beg you, let me go." His guide replied, "Go then, but in a year and a day we meet to part no more." Boyle woke, made his peace with God, and set about a new life. But his old ways slowly entrapped him. The year passed, and the annual meeting came again. His memory of that fateful dream was triggered by the first sentence of the president's opening address. "Gentlemen, this is a leap year. Therefore it is a year and a day since our last annual meeting." It was too much for Archibald Boyle. He left. Next morning, his horse was found grazing quietly by the roadside. A few yards away lay the corpse of Archibald Boyle. the strange guide had claimed him at the appointed time. The Pharisees did eventually kill Jesus. As we remember now, as we gather around the communion table. The communion table is a sign of new creation, of resurrection life, of sin and death defeated, of eternal rest restored. It is when Jesus asks us most passionately, "Do you want to get well?" It's when we bring all our ugly stuff and we lay it at the foot of the cross. It's when we make our peace with God. Now, we have spent these past weeks meeting Jesus afresh. But to really understand Jesus, you have to understand a God-man hanging on a cross and with tears, grieving over your sin and pleading, will you come and get well? Amen.